Maximum Health with your host, Dr. Ken Gray. Dr. Gray obtained his master's in both acupuncture and oriental medicine from the Atlantic Institute of Oriental Medicine. Dr. Gray enjoys both being a physician as well as being an educator. His unique approach to holistic healing has taken him abroad to lecture in Germany and treat sports professionals in Hawaii and France. He is co-author of several books on food therapy. His office is in Jupiter, Florida, where he has practiced for over a decade and where he resides. Now it's time for Maximum Health with Dr. Ken Gray.
Welcome back, everyone. This is Maximum Health Radio, quality living with yours truly, Dr. Ken Gray, holistic physician. Thank you for joining us every Friday at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard. And for any of our past shows, please have a look at PRX, the public radio exchange.org, PRX.org. It's a great way to keep in touch with what we're doing. As you know, every week we have a new guest, and it's so important to know that you're out there and listening. It really keeps us going here at Maximum Health. The guests are from all over the world, and truly, I think we're really indebted to the people that take their time and their lives and give back to humanity in such wonderful ways, well-being and health in all sorts of scopes. Today we have an amazing individual, Dr. Cary Fowler, and I read about him and listened to other interviews on him, and I'm so just honored to have him today. Thank you, Dr. Fowler, for joining us.
Pleasure.
Yeah, when I found that there's someone that's saving seeds in such magnitude and with such attention and taking our future into such consideration despite the majority of us really having no concern, it's something to be honored and really for us to know about. And you are doing, not only are you an author, but your bio is extremely long. But one of the things about Dr. Fowler is perhaps best known as the father of the Global Seed Vault, described by former UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon as an inspirational symbol of peace and food security for the entire humanity. The Seed Vault provides ultimate security for more than 850,000 unique crop varieties, the raw material for all future plant breeding and crop improvement efforts. It seems so futuristic that we would need to do this, but when we look at the food crisis that we are still having globally and then such disregard for maintaining healthy food growing practices, it seems like it's not the future, it's now.
Well, you know, that's right. And I think human beings have always, of course, had their challenges in terms of providing food security for the populations. Agriculture, if you think about it, is not a completely natural system. Perhaps hunting and gathering, you could say, was a natural system, but it's not nature's way to plant large acreages of a particular crop in a single row and hope for the best. So it's a managed system, and our domesticated crops are literally in our hands, as the word domesticated implies. And so what it behooves us to do is to save the raw material for plant evolution. And at some level, that's what I've been trying to do, is to save all the pieces, save the genetic diversity of our different crops for future use, and to enable all of our different crops to evolve in the face of whatever is coming in the future, be it climate change or a new pest or disease or changing human tastes.
Tell me a little bit about your background. Tell us a little bit about your background, Dr. Fowler. What brought you to this point where you found the need to do this and to dedicate your time to doing this and your expertise?
Well, you know, I think most people would assume sort of a linear progression from formal education into scientific jobs like that. But I think, and I could tell such a story, but it really doesn't capture what actually went on in my life. I grew up in the American South, came of age in the 50s and 60s, was very much moved by, and to the extent I could at my age, participated in the civil rights movement in the South, in Memphis. And both sides of my family were very much involved in public service, mostly in education, also housing, but one side of my family also had family farms, and we viewed farmers as public servants as well, and people to be honored. And I didn't quite have it in me to be a farmer, though my grandmother always wanted me to be one. And I suppose I married my two families once again. My father was a judge, my mother was a dietitian, as I mentioned, my grandmother ran a family farm, and I was always interested in what was happening on the family farm, not just on that acreage, but more generally, what was happening to farmers and to the crops. And along the way, I started to write about that, do research, came across this particular problem of the loss of genetic diversity. I guess I discovered that in the 70s, and it seemed to me that here was a gigantic global problem that was occurring totally off the radar screen of not just the most scientists, but the public and certainly policymakers. We were literally facing an extinction event in agriculture, where many of the older varieties the seeds of those varieties were ceasing to be saved by the farmers, who were replacing them with modern and more high-yielding varieties. In a sense, we wanted them to do that. But we had no real system for conserving the diversity that was being lost. And, you know, when you lose this kind of diversity, you're losing particular traits. You're losing the genes that code for, let's say, disease resistance or a particular taste in a vegetable. And once lost, it's lost forever. So you had this ironic situation where a friend of mine described it as equivalent to taking stones from the foundation in order to repair the roof. In other words, we were more and more depending on the modern crop varieties, but what were the modern crop varieties depending on? Where did they come from, and what was their genetic basis? And the answer to that was the old varieties that they were replacing. So obviously this was not going to work.
No. It was amazing growing up and thinking everything was the same, and then you start to notice the change in the blandness in foods, and then all of a sudden this resurgence or a injection of heirloom, the word heirloom, and yeah. This sort of aisle or area of the produce section having heirloom.
Yeah.
Like, interesting.
Well, I remember a point a long time ago where I used to talk to friends about this, and of course their eyes would roll a little bit because I maybe talked about it a little bit too much. And they were telling me that my fascination with some of these heirloom varieties and the notion that they tasted better was just a lot of nostalgia. And of course, I was a little bit scared that maybe that was true. And I remember going on a trip to Africa, the first time I ever went to Africa, and I had a friend in Senegal. I stopped over at his house. We were eating dinner in his garden, fresh tomatoes that he had just picked. I bit into one of those tomatoes, and for no reason at all that I could think of at that time, I thought of my grandmother, with whom I was very close, but she had died several years before that. And that sort of plagued me, and I wondered, well, why is that? Because you and I, all of us know that taste and smells are very strong
connections.
They're very strong connections. And I finally figured it out.
Yeah.
And it was that that tomato tasted like the tomatoes that I grew up having on the family farm.
And that had lost for decades.
And the modern varieties had lost that taste. And that was the point where I was no longer open to the notion that my love of some of the heirloom varieties was simple nostalgia. Yeah.
Well, what was also interesting, too, was that in this endeavor to mass grow, like you said, these crops, and including tomato, there was this marketing that changed the way we viewed vegetables for a while, where the tomato was like a garnish. But the tomato, not even a vegetable, is a fruit. And it's sweet in nature.
Yeah.
It's sweet. It's you could sit and eat a tomato like you would an apple or a strawberry, and it's very sweet when it's in its original form, you know, untampered.
Yeah, and there's so many different varieties. My wife is really the big gardener in the family, and we're probably she's probably growing, I don't know, 50 or 75 different varieties this summer, as in most summers, and they have so many different uses and so many different tastes, and come in all kinds of colors and shapes and sizes, of course.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then the other thing is, too, is with the loss of the flavor and the nature comes the loss of the health benefits, the deep-seated health benefits, which obviously involve anti-cancer fighting and, you know, preservation of certain organs and so forth and so on.
Well, I think there's a loss of a cultural connection with the with our foods, too. If you have a generation, a younger generation than I, coming up that really doesn't know what a great tomato tastes like, then it will be possible to sell them and certainly sell their children just about anything.
Yeah, yeah. This is true.
And that's very sad because in a very real sense, our domesticated crops have co-evolved with us. And these older varieties in particular have a cultural history that's linked to various cultures and cultural uses of those materials, not to mention the environmental differences that they come from. And those are precious things, cannot be easily reconstructed, and they're part of our own history, and I think are deserving of conservation.
I agree fully. So the early 1990s, the UN's Food and Agriculture Organization, FAO, recruited you to lead the team to produce the first global assessment of the state of the world's plant genetic resources. Tell us a little bit about that era.
That was an interesting time. I was I knew that the UN was going to initiate such a study. I was a bit surprised they called on me. They had checked it out with a number of different countries, and I seemed to be the one that the different countries could agree on to lead that effort. It was designed to be essentially an assessment of the situation and a problem statement, which would be linked with something called a global plan of action, which was also sort of part of the project that I led, that was going to be a negotiated plan of action that countries hopefully would agree to. So I think what we found, we surveyed all the countries in the world. We looked very closely at their conservation efforts and what kind of diversity they had. And to put it bluntly, it was scary because what we found was that most of the seed banks that were set up in a way to provide long-term conservation for the seed diversity that they had in the different countries just weren't functioning properly. So we were losing a lot of diversity. We really were in the midst of an extinction event in agriculture, and one from which we couldn't come back. So, you know, most all countries have seed banks, but very, very few of them are running properly. None of them, even our own in the United States, doesn't have a secure multi-year budget that's sufficient. And that's not even to speak about what kind of capacity the staffing has in some of these facilities. Sometimes I go out and give talks to scientific communities, and I say, well, there's several hundred legitimate, real seed banks in the world. How many good seed bank managers do you think there are? And that gets some laughter, because people understand that while a facility might be good, even though they're not, that we don't really have that many good managers of these seed banks. So this is a system that sometimes we shouldn't be using the word system attached to it. And that was very frightening. So that led to a global plan of action, which 150 countries agreed to in 1996, to actually do something about this and to try to create a rational, efficient, global system, rather than sort of every man for himself, if you will. That was what was going on prior to that, and not working.
How's that going now?
Well, I think it's going reasonably well, but obviously it's very hard to it's really hard to get countries to move them to a space where they are cooperating for the global good, rather than purely looking out for, what's in this for me.
Right. So, and I guess about 150 countries adopted this plan, correct?
That's right.
And so with 150 countries, I'm sure some of those are poverty-stricken countries where this is not a priority. Although it's important, it's just not a priority to them, but they're still struggling for clean water or in certain areas of their country or what have you. I mean,
yeah. Well, there are issues of capacity in some countries, and then there are issues of political will in others. Mm-hmm. And sometimes those things match up in odd ways. If you look at Ethiopia, for instance, one of the year in and year out, one of the poorest countries in the world, has made a major investment in trying to conserve crop diversity, and they happen to be a country that has a lot of richness, genetic richness, mm-hmm. in terms of their crop diversity world. But there's also a lot of politics involved in this, and there are certainly countries that seem to think that they are sitting on a genetic gold mine, that sooner or later someone will realize that they have a very important trait for such and such crop, and that they can actually sell it and make a commodity out of it. And so what I've spent many years trying to say, with a little bit of success but still not a great deal of success, is that all countries are interdependent. There's not a single country in the world, not one, that has a seed bank that has the diversity that it will need in the future without reliance on what's contained in other countries' seed banks.
Right.
So if you look at a country like the United States, which has, of course, phenomenal infrastructure in terms of seed conservation and plant breeding, we have about 5% of the world's wheat samples, huge wheat bread industry, but only 5% of the wheat samples. And I often tell countries, well, if you're in America, how confident are you that in the future all you will need for helping wheat adapt to climate change or another pest or disease is contained in that group of samples, mm-hmm. which is 5% of the global total? Yeah. So obviously we're interdependent.
Yeah, that puts it in perspective, doesn't it, for a lot of people?
Well, it sure does. And if you're a small country, you're not even going to have 5%. Mm-hmm. And by the way, the materials that you have in your seed bank probably have predominantly come from your own country. Mm-hmm. Great, they're adapted to your cultures, to your soil conditions, to your climate. But hey, a lot of those things are now changing. So will the seeds that you have in your seed bank that have a long, long, multi-year history in your country be adapted to the kinds of climates, for example, that are coming now?
Yeah. And like you said, pests. I mean, you know, the reality is one of the biggest flaws we have is this, as humans, is this God complex. Obviously, we want to control. And the more we try to use antibiotics or certain chemicals on our bodies, whether it's us as humans or the vegetables and fruits and, you know, different crops, we're seeing that it's weakening them because they're not allowed to live and evolve.
Well, you know, I find this in the garden myself, that I have an apple orchard that has about 125 different varieties in it of apples. Most of them the older sorts of apples. They're planted fairly close together, and I can have one tree that really suffers from a rust disease that strikes apples, standing right next to a tree with beautiful, unaffected leaves. Mm-hmm. And so I guess, you know, there are a number of lessons here. One is that not all apples are created equal.
Right.
Another is that if you're looking at these old heirloom varieties, you have to realize that they're old heirloom varieties for a couple of reasons.
Yes.
One is they have stood the test of time.
Yes.
So there must have been something going on, very positive, that they would have survived all these years. But they survived in a certain climate and environment, social and natural. So if you have an heirloom variety, you grow an heirloom variety of apple or tomato, it's not necessarily going to do well in your backyard.
Right.
Because maybe it was an heirloom that was suited to and survived for hundreds of years in Britain. Mm-hmm. But you move it to New York and it's out of its element and doesn't do quite so well.
Right.
So gardeners have to be, and I think they're a great resource, have to be experimenters.
Yeah.
And they have to watch, and they have to be smart about that, and they have to help these plants, and they have to make decisions. We're not immune to natural selection.
No. and then in 2015, U.S. President, then former President Barack Obama, appointed you to the Board for International Food and Agricultural Development, and since then you've gone on to do many more things, including a current book, The Seed Vault?
It's called Seeds on Ice.
Seeds on Ice, sorry.
Mm-hmm.
And the Seeds on Ice book is already obviously had a lot of awards, and it's a must-read. Tell us about the writing of that book and some of the jewels we'll find in it.
Well, I was very involved in the very beginnings of conceptualizing the Seed Vault in the Arctic, above mainland Norway, and for many years I headed the committee that came up with the proposal for it and the management plan for the Seed Vault, proposed it to Norway, and was involved in the construction and until recently was head of the council that oversaw the operations of the Seed Vault. So I've probably been as much or more involved than many other individuals in its founding and operation. And I noticed that there's a lot of interest in the popular media about the Seed Vault, which included, unfortunately at times, some kind of wild stories and some that were not terribly accurate. And I thought, well, gosh, I'm almost the only one that's been here from start to finish, and I really know what the story is. So I think something of this magnitude that is designed to help all nations on Earth and to last essentially forever needs to have its story told. So I decided it was time to sit down and write the story of the Seed Vault. Write the story of where crop diversity comes from and why it's important, how it's being lost, and what we did to bring together countries to save that diversity. So that's Seeds on Ice, mm-hmm. and it's I tell the story in text, but much of the story in this book is really told in some absolutely gorgeous photographs. We have a couple hundred photographs, so it's a little bit like a serious coffee table book, I would say.
Beautiful. Well, I would encourage all of our listeners, Seeds on Ice, definitely a must-have. Some of your past works, Shattering Food Politics and the Loss of Genetic Diversity, which is, I guess, there's also a more academic book, Unnatural Selection, Technology, Politics, and Plant Evolution. So these are all books that can be found from Dr. Carrie Fowler. His website is carriefowler.com. That's CarrieFowler. And again, those of you listening, please, if you've missed any part of the show, you'll need to go to prx.org and have a listen. It's truly enriching, encouraging, inspirational, and I think it really lets us know that we do have a responsibility on a global level for many things, but especially preserving our genetic diversity of our food so that we can also survive. Thank you, Dr. Fowler.
Thank you, Ken. It's been a real pleasure.
All right. Till next time, this is Maximum Health, Quality Living with yours truly, Dr. Ken Gray, holistic physician. See you next time.